All right, good afternoon to you again. I made Elder Bogus a promise when I first arrived here on Sunday, and he said, "Bob, I want you to put your teaching hat on, not your preaching hat." And I told him that that was my intention, but I have been doing a little preaching the last couple of days, and I have a confession to make. I've got a few more minutes of that for you today, but I think it's important for us to understand really the depth of the issues that I've kind of touched on and described lightly for you, really, over the last couple of days about some of the serious crisis in our food supply and our food system. I know that most of you are folks that are gardeners and you want some gardening information too, and we're going to get to that. But I think that for those of you that need some encouragement and a little boost to get yourselves out there and to get started gardening, what I have to share with you today may just kind of tip you over the edge a little bit. I wasn't initially planning to share this with you, but I was discussing some of this information with one of the pastors yesterday, and he said, "Bob, you really need to share this too. You really need to draw these connections." Now, I mentioned to you early on that what we're dealing with here is a great controversy issue. Can you all see that? Is that pretty apparent to you? Well, if that's the case, then we know that there's an influence or a force that's behind every aspect of the problems that we face in the food system today. Is that fair enough to say? All right, and we know where that power comes from. I want to just take a few minutes today and talk a little bit about this food safety legislation that's been recently passed and where it came from and what it's really intended to do. The food safety bill, the initial bill, was passed in the House on July 30th of 2009. That was H.R. 2749, the Food Safety Enhancement Act. The Food Safety Enhancement Act was a piece of legislation written by a congresswoman from Connecticut named Rosa DeLauro. Her husband is an attorney that works as a lobbyist for Monsanto. And the gist of the text of that particular legislation would have basically made it impossible for small growers like me to continue to function in the marketplace. I could still grow food for myself and my family, but trying to produce food under the guidelines that were in that original legislation would have made it virtually impossible for me to sell my products. The Senate took up that legislation and passed their version of it, which was Senate Bill 510. This happened last December. The bill was passed on December 22nd and signed into law on January 4th. The language in the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is ultimately what this has come to be known, is a little bit less onerous for small growers, but it still has some huge impacts on all of us that really want to make a living from growing crops. Now, in this country right now, there's a huge local food movement going on. You probably noticed it in your communities. Farmers markets are burgeoning all over the place. They're popping up. You see farm stands here and there. Those of us that pay attention to agriculture issues notice that even in large urban environments, places like Detroit, they're taking vacant lots and planting vegetable farms in those places. And people's awareness for the nutritional value of fresh, locally grown food is rising enormously. Now, this is taking profits out of the hands of some of those that would prefer to see us continue with the status quo, buying the commercial products through the traditional channels. So we have a real conflict going on right now. This food safety legislation is intended to do a few things. It's intended, first and foremost, to harmonize U.S. food standards with Codex Alimentarius. Any of you heard that term before, Codex Alimentarius? This is a term that most Americans are not familiar with, and I'm going to explain it to you in just a couple minutes here quickly. This food safety legislation requires federal licensing of all food processors. Now, there is an exemption for what they call very small growers, and a very small grower at this point in time is someone like me, someone that sells less than $500,000 worth of produce in a three-year period of time. Also, I cannot ship what I grow more than 275 miles without paying this federal license fee. Now, to me, that's a bit of a disadvantage because one of the long-term objectives that we have is to produce and sell some seed. And if I mail order seed, I can't sell it farther than 275 miles away without getting this federal license now. And a food processor, under the language of this bill, is anybody that washes a head of lettuce, for example. So when I go to the farmer's market this year, if I'm going to comply with this new food safety legislation, I can't rinse any of my produce. I've got to take it as I harvest it out of the field. Otherwise, I'm considered a food processor. This fee that they want to assess, whether you're a large corporation like Dole or some little podunk market farm like Berea Gardens, is $1,000 a year. Many of the people that I know that participate in our farmer's market don't even make $1,000 a year. So immediately, they're out of business. It requires field-to-fork record keeping. Basically, if you're going to comply with this new safety legislation, you have to maintain records about every sale and where the produce went. I have to keep records on everything that I grow, and I have to track each sale. If I sell to a restaurant or to another small market, I have to know what I grew, the date that I sold it, and what I sold to them, and they likewise have to follow up with some pretty extensive record keeping too. Now, for a small business, this can be pretty overwhelming. I spend the majority of my time just growing the crops that we sell, and my wife handles the farmer's market for me, usually on Wednesdays, but apart from that, I'm spending most of my time in the field trying to grow this stuff to sell, and if I have to keep records on all of this, it's going to make things a lot more difficult for us. It allows the federal government, the FDA, to have rights for search and seizure of, at any time, of all of our farm records. And they can determine what those farm records might be and where they might be, and basically take our computers, take any records that I might have, any files that I might have, anything that they feel that they can glean some information from, they will have the right to seize and to use. Thank you, brother. One of the stipulations in this bill that has the Amish community quite concerned is that all of the record keeping has to be filed electronically. That means it has to be in a computer format. And many of our Amish friends that don't have power and don't, by their faith, subscribe to that type of technology are not going to be allowed to conduct business. It provides regional quarantines for food, meaning that if my neighbor down the road happens to have an issue with the Food and Drug Administration that involves some form of contamination, perhaps if his pigs got into his spinach patch and they decided that it was contaminated with E. coli, they can quarantine all the food within a region, and that region is undefined. That could be the neighborhood, it could be the county, it could be the state, could be a larger region. So it gives them the capacity to basically shut down all of the local food production within a given area. One of the most troubling aspects of this legislation is that it gives the FDA discretion to dictate to us farmers how we grow our foods and what inputs we use to grow our foods. They have the capacity to come onto our farms at any time and inspect what's going on, and if they don't like what they see, without any recourse or any opportunity for us to repeal their decision, they can tell us what we need to do. For example, I have friends that have farms that aren't fenced. Mine are all fenced because I anticipated this legislation and I knew they wouldn't like the ideas of our dog walking through our garden. But if your gardens are not fenced and there's any opportunity that wildlife could come in and defecate in your gardens, they could consider that a hazard and require you to install a fence. If they, for some reason, decided that one of the varieties of plants that I was growing was particularly susceptible to a potential foodborne pathogen, they could tell me that I can't grow that variety of broccoli anymore, I have to grow this variety of broccoli. If I'm using composted manures, horse manures or something, from my neighbors on my crops, and they determine that that's a hazard, they can say, nope, I'm sorry, Bob, you can't do that anymore. We want you to use a commercial grade of urea or ammonium nitrate as your nitrogen source rather than that. It gives them incredible dictatorial power over what goes on farms. and for small growers, this can be and will be very onerous over a period of time. Right now, we have a little window of opportunity, or a little breathing space, I should say, because with the new Republican Congress, there are a lot of fights about the budgeting to implement this program. And to this point in time, the FDA has not received the amount of money that they need to really fully enforce all of this. And how long it will take them to enforce this legislation down to the level of a small grower like me, I don't really know. But what I do know is that they now have the tools in their box. Should they choose to shut me down, they can do it. They can do it. And they can not only do it to me, but they could do it to anybody else for a variety of different reasons that are all very subjective on the part of the inspector. Now, the person that's been appointed by President Obama to oversee this new program is a man named Michael Taylor. And I think it's kind of interesting to know that Michael Taylor was appointed to this position on July 7th of 2009. Do you remember when I told you that the House passed the original version of this bill? It was on July 30th of 2009. So even before the legislation was passed, the president had selected his person to oversee this legislation and implement it. Now, Michael Taylor is an individual that causes me great concern in this position. And in many ways, it's like putting the fox in charge of the hen house here. Because Michael Taylor was the man who worked for a lobbying organization. He was an attorney working for a lobbyist that basically worked with the first Bush administration in drawing up the regulations, or the lack of regulations, I should say, governing biotechnology. After that, and this, remember, our program of substantial equivalence, this was his influence that pressed its way into government policy. He was working for the FDA at that time. After he got that legislation approved, he went to work for Monsanto as vice president. Then he went back to the FDA for a while, then he went back to Monsanto for a while, and most recently he was appointed by President Obama to oversee this safety program. But the primary purpose of this program is, as I said, to bring us into harmonization with Codex Alimentarius. Well, what in the world is Codex Alimentarius? Codex Alimentarius is literally translated from the Latin, means food rules. And this is a voluntary compliance system from a supra-governmental organization that we all know called the United Nations, the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization of the United Nations are the ones that are sponsoring Codex Alimentarius. The concept behind Codex Alimentarius is to bring worldwide standards to our food supply. Worldwide standards in terms of what we have available, how food is processed and handled, chemical contamination levels, a variety of different things. And for those of you that are in the health ministry's aspect of our work, you may be familiar with some things that have happened recently in the European Union based on decisions to comply with Codex Alimentarius, and that is that you can no longer get therapeutic doses of vitamins in the European Union without a doctor's prescription. And just recently, within the last 4 weeks or so, you can no longer sell herbal dietary supplements in the European Union. And the far-reaching aspects of complying with these Codex Alimentarius rules are really pretty intimidating. Now, one of the things that's on the agenda for Codex is irradiation of food. They've admitted that. You can look at the minutes of their meetings, and that's freely stated. And we know that this is part of the agenda that this Food Safety Modernization Act, too, is going to bring about. Well, where did Codex come from, and how is it that such an insidious organizational control of our food supply has taken place? To really understand this, we have to look back into history a little bit. We have to look back to the 1830s when a man named Francis Galton, who was a half-cousin of Charles Darwin, came up with a concept he coined eugenics. And Galton basically looked at the work that Charles Darwin had done in his Origin of the Species and decided that, well, you know, we've been breeding racehorses and we've been breeding dogs and we've been controlling the offspring of many different forms of life for a long time. If we applied these methods to mankind, we can improve mankind through our own self-direction. And that was the concept that came to be called eugenics. Now, early in the 1920s, this movement, this eugenics movement, was very, very popular right here in the United States. Many of the leading elite families in this country subscribed to this philosophy, including the DuPonts, the Rockefellers of Standard Oil. Edsel Ford was a member of the original American Eugenics Society, Paul Warburg. Many others were very powerful people ascribed to this kind of a philosophy of basically controlling the evolution, if you will, of mankind by processes of selection. And these processes of selection took kind of a very dark turn back in the 1930s when many states passed laws, including the state of Virginia, that basically prohibited anyone with serious physical disabilities from reproducing. There were mass forced sterilizations of people so that they could not reproduce. And the American Eugenics Society was at the forefront of this. Now, during this time, all of these companies on the left-hand side of your screen here were doing business with a large conglomerate in Germany called IG Farben. IG Farben was a German corporation that had the four subsidiaries on the right-hand side of this screen, AGFA, BASF, Bayer, and Hoechst. And many of these philosophical eugenics concepts were conveyed widely among the world's elite during this period of time, which eventually led to something that happened that we're all aware of, and that was the Holocaust of World War II. IG Farben was the manufacturer of Zyklon B, the toxic gas that was used in the gas chambers for the extermination of Jews. And there's a man, the man that's standing immediately to the left of Adolf Hitler here, is a man named Fritz Termeer. Fritz Termeer was eventually convicted. He was working for IG Farben at the time, but he was eventually convicted for war crimes because he ran the forced labor camps at Auschwitz. He was sentenced to 7 years, and when he was in prison, he came up with a new idea for controlling the world instead of using guns and bombs, and that was to take control of the food supply. Fritz Termeer proposed this concept of Codex Alimentarius to the United Nations. It was adopted by the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and became firmly established a couple of decades ago. Now, there is a long agenda to what Codex Alimentarius has to do with our food supply, but we see this playing out right before our eyes right now. It's important to note that these companies are all still in business. And the philosophical bent of these companies, I'll leave you to decide, but if you look at the fruits of what they have done, I think you can recognize that there is still a very serious issue with the integrity of the motivations of these various corporations in terms of our health and well-being. BASF is very closely aligned to DuPont Chemicals. Bayer and Monsanto have been essentially doing business together for a long period of time. In fact, when I was working as an ag consultant in California, there was a company called Mobay, it's no longer in existence, that was a combination of Bayer and Monsanto that sold pesticides. And Hoechst has gone through a few different transitions and ultimately has become Syngenta. It's important to note that DuPont, Monsanto, and Syngenta are all patent holders of biotech seeds and all major suppliers in the world seed market. This man right here, some of you from high school biology might remember, James Watson received the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1962, along with Francis Crick, for discovering the structure of the DNA molecule. Well, he got himself in trouble a few years ago by making some very disparaging statements about a certain segment of the American population that demonstrated that he still has very powerful eugenics influence in his thinking, and he was forced to resign as the chancellor of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. The Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory is the home of the Eugenics Records Office and the headquarters of the American Eugenics Society, And currently, today, they hold patents, 44 patents for genetically modified corn varieties. You starting to get the picture here? This is not a pretty picture. Pardon? Yes, there is definitely an agenda. So for those of us that are on the fence thinking that, well, we can just buy organic stuff and we can continue to go to Walmart and the Walmart store that I have sells organic tofu, and we think we can insulate ourselves from the influences, these dark influences that have taken control over our food supply, think again. It's time for us, brothers and sisters, to have a revival of our sense of personal responsibility when it comes to simple tasks that require our effort, our sweat, and to engage in learning more about feeding ourselves, taking care of ourselves and our neighbors. As I said yesterday, service is a massive component of this as well. This isn't a self-protection issue. This is an issue that is going to affect all of us, including our neighbors, our brothers and sisters, and we better start to take it seriously. Romans 1, 18 through 25 kind of gives us a picture of the philosophies that have driven these people, and ultimately, the last part of that scripture tells us that they changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, and that's exactly what we see with this technology. In Genesis 1, 11 and 12, we have the blueprint for how plants were intended to reproduce, God's plan for reproducing plants. And I'll let you read this for yourself. Most of you are familiar with this, but I want you to note in particular that there is some redundancy in the statements here. Seed after his kind, whose seed is in itself. Now, years ago when I was reading this scripture, I used to think, wow, why would the Lord be so redundant in saying that? Isn't it obvious, you know, that beans produce beans? And you know, he knew the end from the beginning, and he was preparing this scripture for our time. Brother Bohr, I know, speaks tremendously about the impact of the prophetic aspects of Genesis. And in this sense, I think we see some prophecy here, too. You have a question. Everybody hear me okay? Okay.
Basically, what you're saying is these big corporations, this is just one aspect, these big corporations are modifying the corn and all these other things. They're not producing seed. In the next couple of years, we won't be able to produce seed unless we're producing it ourselves now.
Unless you're buying the seed from these companies actually are producing seed, but they're producing seed according to their specifications, and we will be dependent on that seed unless we take some steps very soon.
The next level and said these seeds will not produce but 1 year's and then
I'm going to explain that in just a moment. Thank you though for raising that. You know, Isaiah, there's a passage in Isaiah 2 that comes to my mind when I consider this issue, and that's Isaiah 17, 10, and 11. Again, I want to move quickly, so I'll just let you read this, but I want to translate that term strange slips for you that's in the center of this passage. That word strange can also be translated as profane. But I'll give you opportunity to look that up again. Now, there's a statement from the spirit of prophecy, too, that kind of is appropriate here. Many of you are familiar with this from Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, page 64. She tells us, describing the state of affairs just prior to the flood, if there was one sin above another which called for the destruction of the race by the flood, it was the base crime of amalgamation of man and beast. Why? Because it defaced the image of God and it caused confusion everywhere. Now, it seems plain to me, I don't know about you, but it seems plain to me that with what's going on in the realm of biotechnology today, we have examples of this same kind of amalgamation. In fact, we do have amalgamation of man and beast. There are goats, pigs, cattle, mice, and sheep that have all been modified with human genes. The goats have been modified with a gene from in order to make a protein in their milk that is similar to human milk. The pigs have been modified with an array of different genes to make their organs more suitable for transplant without rejection. But brothers and sisters, if this is an amalgamation, I need some education because it certainly seems that way to me. These are some of the examples of what they're working with. And you'll notice the pig over here with the fluorescent snout. Part of the reason it has a fluorescent snout and fluorescent hooves because they incorporated a gene from a jellyfish to know that the other genetic part of the genetic cassette that they transferred into that pig had been received by that pig, that this pig indeed did have human genes. So that's kind of a marker. The larvae up in the upper left-hand corner are boll weevil larvae. There are insects that have been genetically modified, as well as this mouse that has human genes in it, and so on. Just to give you an indication of the fact that I think this is unsafe, we have at least 65 documented health effects from the consumption of genetically modified foods. And most of this research has come out of Europe because, again, the powers that are behind this particular technology are funding a great deal of research in this country through our land-grant universities, and there aren't too many people that are willing to bite the hand that feeds them. So much of this research has come out of Europe, but we have a lot of various different things that have happened. We also have another aspect to this that is not listed there, and that is that we have instances where we've been able to document that genetically modified foods actually have anti-nutritive properties, meaning that when you consume these things, the reaction in the body is such that the body rejects the nutrition in that food, realizing that it's a foreign body. So there are some very serious elements here that I just want you to be aware of. And again, the scriptures have given us an indication that at the end of time we're going to be facing some very interesting things. And from Revelation 18 and verse 23, talking about the destruction at the end, it says that all nations were deceived by their sorceries. And that word sorcery there, does anybody know what that root of that word is? That's pharmakia. That's pharmakia. And all of these companies that we've been talking about that are controlling our seed supply now, as I mentioned before, are pharmaceutical companies. So we're facing some serious issues here, folks. And it's time for us to strap on some appropriate footwear, step out into those fields, and to start to take some responsibility for producing some of our food ourselves. I mentioned plant-derived pharmaceuticals that are being genetically modified. The potential for contamination of these is very high into our food supply. And we also have this issue that the pastor was raising just a moment ago, and it's called terminator technology. One of the concerns about genetically modified plants is that pollen from these plants carries the genetic code that has been altered, and it can contaminate other crops. Industry's response to this was to develop terminator technology, or what they call GERTs, genetic use restriction technologies, so that the seed will only remain viable for one growing season and it will not reproduce after that. It produces a sterile seed. Now, they promised us when genetically modified crops were first released into the environment that they would not outcross with either wild species or with other crops. That has proven to be patently false in both situations. We've had many crops that have become contaminated with these genetic characteristics through pollen drift and other means. We also have natural weeds now that have developed capacities for herbicide resistance because they have even outcrossed with wild species. Now, if this terminator technology should outcross, you can imagine what would happen to the world food supply. And because we have narrowed the gene pool so much, no longer are farmers retaining their particular varieties of seed from year to year. They're all buying from the same companies. They're all buying the same varieties. We're all genetically in the same boat. If there is one catastrophic disease that should attack these crops, we're also going to see catastrophic failure in the food supply. To me, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. We are so close to the precipice on this issue that it's not a question in my mind as to whether it will occur, it's just a matter of when it will occur. Again, I want to just review the quick list here. If any of you have further questions about any of this, you can look to my website. There's a wealth of information there, and I'd be happy to speak with you individually too. But I'd kind of like to move on now and start talking about what we can do as an alternative to all of this. And that is basically what people were encouraged to do back during World War II, and that is grow your own vegetables. back when we were in the last major world war, folks all over this country took responsibility for themselves and planted gardens so that they would have things available to them so that they could feed themselves. Brothers and sisters, we're at war today. Whether it's the war on terror, the economic war that's going around the world, the spiritual war that's going on through this great controversy, we are at war. And we need our victory gardens. It's imperative that we plant our victory gardens if we're going to accomplish the work that we need to accomplish. Now, I know many of you have asked this question, and I want to spend a little time today talking about seeds, because I've just given you a whole background here on how contaminated the food supply is and what's wrong with the seed that's in the food supply, and what do we do? Where do we go? Where do we turn? What are our resources? I want to talk first, before I give you a list of resources, about the types of seed that we have available to us today. And the two primary types of seed that I suggest making use of are varieties that we call open-pollinated varieties and also hybrid varieties, and I want to describe what the difference is here for some of you and dispel some of the myths about hybrid seed. An open-pollinated variety is also called a landrace or a heritage variety or sometimes an heirloom variety. Those last two terms are really marketing terms. I get kind of uncomfortable when I hear people call their seed heritage seed, and you'll see why in just a minute here. But open-pollinated varieties are very good seeds for you to acquire now, because open-pollinated varieties of crops will produce seed that you can save and use the next year and reproduce the same crop over and over and over again. This is essentially the type of seed that farmers used prior to the 1920s when hybridization of seed kind of became popular in the U.S. But open-pollinated varieties are essential for our long-term food security. And basically, an open-pollinated variety, I'm sorry here, but I've discovered that being gifted in agricultural skills and being gifted in illustrative skills are mutually exclusive. I'm a very poor artist. But what I've written on the board here, basically, is the outline of a flower with the two parts of the flower here, this being the pistil, or the female portion of the flower, and these are the anthers and stamens with the pollen on them. And a self-pollinated variety basically does just that. The pollen from this flower or the same plant in the row can pollinate and produce a seed that reproduces very true to type. Genetically, it's almost the same as its parents. That has some real advantages for long-term food security because that's the source of our seed. Now, there are also plants available to us today called hybrids. And a lot of people have some misconceptions about hybrids that I want to dispel. First and foremost, most people think that hybrids are not as nutritious as open-pollinated varieties. That's not always true. In some instances it is, but it's not always true. Most people associate hybrid seed with a laboratory or something that's unnatural. That's not true. Hybridization occurs in nature all the time. In fact, I'm going to make a statement here that may surprise most of you, but virtually all of the foods, the vegetable foods that we eat today, were hybrids. We don't have a single plant that we eat, that we put on our plate, that hasn't at some time in its history been crossed by a bee-carrying pollen or wind-carrying pollen that has created an offspring that is not necessarily the same as that model of open-pollinated. Now, that can only happen with plants of the same species, but it's a perfectly natural process. If I have a particular variety of pumpkin that I am growing and my neighbor has a different pumpkin that he's growing and a bee carries pollen from his flower to my flower and I save that seed and grow it the next year, I'm going to get a cross of those two pumpkins. That's a natural process, though. There's nothing that violates that principle in Genesis 1:11 and 12 in that process. And there are some real advantages to hybrid seed, because in many instances, hybrid varieties have been developed to be more disease resistant. And an example that I can give you is a celebrity tomato. Now, most organic growers, most organic growers kind of frown on the celebrity tomato because they feel that their open pollinated varieties of tomatoes are somehow more pure. I missed an E in here. Somehow more pure, that it's more Edenic, if you will, than using a hybrid seed. Now, there have been some studies on the nutritional value of a celebrity tomato, and frankly, they're a nice-looking tomato. This is a very common tomato. You'll find this in the marketplace when you shop at the grocery store. It's got uniform characteristics. The skin quality is good. It doesn't crack easily. It lasts for a long time, and it tastes fairly good if it's a vine-ripened tomato. I think there are many other tomatoes that taste better. But one of the advantages of the celebrity tomato is that, number one, it's resistant to late blight, and number two, it's resistant to nematodes. Nematodes are small microscopic worms that live in the soil, and if you happen to have those in your soil, a traditional open pollinated tomato may not produce very well. And if you live in an area of the country like we do, where we have hot, humid summers and late blight should strike, oftentimes, an open pollinated tomato without any resistance to late blight will completely collapse. In fact, this happened to us frequently growing tomatoes over in Virginia. We knew that about this time of year, well, maybe a couple more weeks, early July usually, we would get a blast of really hot weather, temperatures in the 90s, humidities in the 90s, maybe a thunderstorm or two in the afternoon, perfect conditions for late blight. And all of our tomato plants would defoliate, we would harvest the tomatoes that were on the plant, but the plants wouldn't produce again until maybe September or October when the weather changed a little bit and the humidity dropped. So if I'm growing an open pollinated variety, and one of the popular open pollinated varieties is called Rutgers, if I'm growing a Rutgers tomato and I have problems with nematodes or late blight, and I only harvest four or five tomatoes on that plant, I'm not going to have enough to meet my needs for the year, am I? But if I grow celebrity tomatoes alongside those Rutgers tomatoes, then I can use the hybrid characteristics of those tomatoes to my advantage and at least have some tomatoes to eat. Even if they're 50% less nutritious, if I've got five times as many tomatoes, ultimately I still have more nutrition, right? So there's an advantage at times to making use of hybrid seed. And a lot of folks say, well, we don't want to do that because you can't save the seed from hybrids and replant it. That's also a myth. You can do that. In fact, I want to outline to you what happens if we save the seed from a hybrid cross. And that's why I've got my little illustration on the board here. Okay? Let's assume that these are two flowers. I know they look nothing like flowers, but we're going to assume that these are two flowers. And I want to show you what the process of hybridization is all about. This is a white flower with a long stem. This is a blue flower with a short stem. And for plant breeding purposes, we want to maybe find a red flower with a long stem. So we've gone through the pedigrees of these, and we realize that there are recessive traits as well as dominant traits in these lines of plants, and it's very possible that I could cross these two by taking pollen from this flower and fertilizing this to produce a seed, and when that seed is produced, I may get a long-stemmed flower that is red. Okay, this is just a hypothetical, but that could be the outcome. All right, this first generation, if you will, is what we call an F1 hybrid. An F1 hybrid. You've seen this in your seed catalogs and on your seed packages, that little F1. That stands for first filial, or first family association. Now, if I take the seed from this flower and I allow it to self-pollinate, what I'm doing here is I'm combining traits from both the seed parent and the pollen parent. And I don't know what I'm going to get. because there is going to be a different combination of those dominant and recessive traits that is expressed. So instead of getting a long-stemmed red flower, I may get a short-stemmed blue flower again. I may get a long-stemmed white flower again. I may get a long-stemmed yellow flower. I have no idea what I'm going to get. But this gets interesting. This is our F1 generation. If I do this, and let's just say that I get a short-stemmed blue flower, this is the F2 generation at this point. When I've self-pollinated the F1 generation, I get an F2 generation. And if I continue this over a period of time, each of these generations, F3, F4, F5, and F6, are going to be different. Now, this can be a lot of fun for home gardeners, because just because I've saved the seed from my F1 hybrid does not mean I'm going to get something less desirable than what I had. I could get something better. It's not often that that happens, but it could happen. But what's interesting is that as we go through the successive generations of crossing this seed, the characteristics of the generations start to stabilize. The dominant characteristics tend over time to become more dominant. And each time we self-cross that variety, we intensify the characteristics. And by the time we get to the seventh generation, God is good, eh? The seventh generation, or the F7 generation, we have a variety that is pretty much stable and qualifies as being an open-pollinated variety or a land race or a heritage variety or an heirloom variety, if you want to call it that. A lot of the seeds that are being sold today as heirlooms are only 7 or 8 years old. They've gone through to that seventh generation, and they will reproduce true to type at that time. Now, part of the reason that hybrid seed is expensive is because there's a lot of time involved here in doing this, right? And if we want to make our own open-pollinated variety from a hybrid variety in our gardens, it's going to take us 7 growing cycles to do that. And we don't know what we're going to end up with when we do. So there's a challenge here for us, but this is kind of fun. And for those of us that are adventurous in nature and have large gardens, you might want to set aside a little space to do some of this. Now, I'll caution you about one thing, though. Since we're using pollen in our initial hybrid cross here, we're using pollen from one flower to pollinate another flower. Oftentimes, the pedigrees of these two parents are studied pretty carefully, too, for a characteristic that makes this process easier. Now, if I'm going to do this in my backyard, I literally have to transfer this pollen to this flower by hand to know that I'm going to get this offspring. One of the ways that it's done on a commercial basis is they will select a flower, particularly the seed parent, that is pollen sterile, so that they can plant the blue variety in amongst the white variety, and they don't have to worry about the white variety pollinating itself. They know that the pollen is going to come from the blue flower. So this sterility gene is being carried down through these generations too, and it can manifest itself at any time. So I could get down here to the F3 generation, for example. That gene could express itself, and my F3 will be sterile, and I won't be able to go any farther. That's one of the disadvantages of growing hybrid seed. Now, obviously, we don't want to rely on hybrid seed for our food security, do we? But it doesn't mean that we can't make a good and prudent use of it in our gardens. And I often think that if we as Seventh-day Adventists had followed counsel and all of us had been gardening for the past 100 years and doing these experiments in our backyards, I wonder what we would have today. Instead of the criteria being imposed on hybrids by the large companies that are looking for yield and shipping quality and endurance and cold storage and all those other things, we could have been evaluating plants for taste and for color and for health properties and for nutritional value. And we'd have a whole different array of hybrids, and our perspective and perception of hybrids would be very, very different. Yes, sir.
I like candy corn, and so, and it was getting pretty expensive lately, and so I thought, well, that was a year ago, I said, I'll save the seed, and I'll plant the seed, and I'll raise my own candy corn. And out of a whole row of about 150 or 200 feet, I probably got three or four or five plants.
Part of the... Right, and that's what I was saying about this sterility gene. Now, particularly with corn, this is a very common practice, that they will select a seed parent that is pollen sterile. Because with corn, otherwise, if you're producing a field of seed corn, you've got to go out and detassel all those seed parents. And in fact, years ago, that was a very common practice. Up in Indiana and many of the areas where they were producing corn seed, they would hire lots of kids during the summer to go out there and detassel the corn for that reason. But the other option they have is breeding this sterility gene in, and that's what I'm saying. You don't know what the output is going to be. You don't want to rely on that for your food security. But it doesn't mean that it's anything that's mysterious or that we shouldn't make use of where we can. Okay? Yes, I have one other comment here.
Would you have to keep bees out of there?
Pardon me?
Would you have to keep bees out if you're taking it from B and putting it over in W?
In reality, yes. In reality, where they produce seed, there are some pretty strict criteria that are used in order to produce pure seed, yes. Yes, because you want to avoid that as much as possible. Okay? The other question that I have, I have one more here and then I'll move on. Can you speak up, please? You don't have a microphone.
And you know, we're gardeners, but we're not scientists. How can we get into all this?
Okay.
We need to rely on somebody else.
Yeah. At this point, you do.
Show us what is right.
Right. Well, I want to share with you, you know, you pointed out something that is an issue here, and that is you are dependent on somebody else providing seed to you. And apparently the seed that you got last year, especially if it was a broad spectrum of different plant types, if none of it germinated, something went wrong somewhere in the storage of that seed. And this is why I'm telling all of you that we need to become responsible and learn these things. Now, granted, you aren't all scientists, but these elements of understanding that we need to grow our own food are not that complex. And I'm going to invite you to come to a training program at Berea Gardens by which you will have the opportunity to understand how to do this and how to take care of that. Right. You know, education is the answer to all of these problems, brothers and sisters, and I know that. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's why we settled here in West Virginia and we bought an old school building and we offer training programs because we realize the desperate need that there is for that. But I want to point out that right now we have sources of seed available to us that are just fine. And I'm going to outline those for you in just a minute. I'll get to you in a moment, brother. We have sources of seed available to us that are just fine, that are good quality seeds, that are free of this genetic modification. But if we don't take advantage of this now, I'm not saying that same array of seeds is going to be out there next year. And part of the reason I say that is because these large multinational corporations have been very, very aggressive in buying up seed companies. And they are essentially gobbling up all the small independent seed producers. We still have a nucleus of folks in this country that value open pollinated heirloom varieties and that even have an appreciation for the hybrid varieties that are useful to us for disease resistance and productivity and so on. But I don't know how much longer that's going to be the case. A lot of folks that I know use Johnny's Seeds, for example. Now, Johnny's is a good company. They've been around for many years. They carry a lot of good varieties of seeds. But what most people don't realize is that Johnny's doesn't produce all those seeds. They're brokers. They buy from growers that grow that seed. And there may be as many as 100 or 200 different sources that they have for the seed that they sell you. But what I can tell you is they're selling you a lot of seed that comes from a company called Syngentis, whose parent company is Monsanto. That's how integrated these companies are with each other. So when we run into a situation where we want to be certain about the quality of our food, certain about the quality of our seeds, the only way we're going to do that for sure is if we grew it and we saved it from last year and we planted it. Okay? Now, I don't want to be an alarmist here, but folks, we can see the writing on the wall. We've seen what's happened over the past decade in our food system. We see what's going on with the oil supplies in this country. We see what's going on with food prices. We see the aggregation and the concentration of power controlling food, not just here in this country, but really on a worldwide basis by supranational organizations. When are we going to wake up and realize that we can mitigate some of this if we take some responsibility ourselves? And it doesn't require acres of land to do this. In fact, over the course of the next couple of days, I think I will surprise you with the potential productivity of the land. This photograph that you see here, this is our demonstration garden that's right behind our school building. That's a portion of the school building that we bought. We have five of these small greenhouses that are 16 feet by 50 feet long. And these garden beds here, this is a row of green beans here. These are garden beds that are 5 feet wide. Yesterday, I told you about our cucumber miracle last year, and that was this row right here. They're just starting to crawl on the trellises. This photograph is from almost exactly a year ago today. Right now at home, the beds look very similar to this. I've done crop rotation, so they're in different places. But this bed right here was 5 feet long, 5 feet wide, 50 feet long, and we harvested 1,100 pounds of cucumbers off that bed and then stopped counting. So the productivity, if we apply the right agricultural principles, is enormous. We can do this. You can do this. And you don't have to be a scientist, but what is required is something that you folks may not have, and that's experimental knowledge. Now, I want to say something else. In the beginning, God created man, set him in a garden to dress it and keep it. That was man's purpose. It's still our purpose today to some degree. That hasn't changed. Inside all of us, God has given the wisdom to meet this need we have for food. We have gardening skill inside of us that has remained untapped and latent for generations. It's there. How do I know it's there? I can prove it to you. One of the elders of our church, very consecrated individual, moved to West Virginia from the city environment about a decade ago, took a job and worked as an administrator in a hospital system, and he started planting a garden. He didn't have any idea what he was doing, but he just went out there because he knew from his study of the Bible and the spirit of prophecy that it was essential that he spend time in that garden, and he started doing it, but he did it prayerfully. He prayed every time he entered that garden. Last year, after a seminar that we did at Berea Gardens, he decided that, maybe I ought to approach this a little more scientifically. And he took a soil sample. He said, "Bob, can you help me interpret this? You know, I want to do this better. I'm retired now. I can spend more time on the garden. I want to get better results. And take a look at this for me and see what I can do." He brought me a soil sample. I sent it to the laboratory. I got the results back 4 days later. And when I looked at the results, I was astonished because his results were very near perfect. This is a man that didn't have any idea about what to do, but he went out there and the Holy Spirit guided him day after day, year after year, while he was working in his garden. And whatever he did, he couldn't even remember most of what he did, but whatever he did was right because he had very nearly perfect soil. Now, this is an area where the soil pH is typically about 5.2, very acidic soil, low in calcium, low in zinc, low in boron. All of his numbers were up in a very healthy range. One year he had added some hay, next year he pulled some leaves out of the forest and he was trying to do it organically. He put a little bit of lime on one year, maybe, he couldn't remember. But he was moving under the unction of the Holy Spirit and had excellent results. And you can too, because that knowledge is inside of us. We were gardeners from the very beginning. I want to mention just one variety of seed that we as home gardeners need to be cautious of. I'll get to you in just a moment. And that is this stuff right here. Most people ask me about whether there are GMO seeds in their seed catalogs or if they go to Walmart and they're looking for vegetable seeds. Right now, the answer to that, with this exception, is no. We do not have genetically modified seeds yet that are widespread in the seeds that are available for home gardeners. Why is that? Well, it's because the companies make money on these genetically modified seeds with patent fees. So they've gone after crops that are grown on a massive scale. If you'll notice that list of GMO crops, they're all crops that are grown on a massive scale, most of which are subsidized, because you remember me yesterday telling you the advantage to the supply companies because of the farm subsidy system. At this point in time, things like broccoli and lettuce and carrots and beets are pretty much free from the influence of this genetic modification. So we can still buy seeds pretty freely and not be concerned about whether there's GMO in them or not. And in the case where there is, and this is the one exception that I know of right now, is a corn seed called Attribute. Attribute is a corn seed that was developed by Syngenta and it's sold by one of their subsidiaries called Rogers Seed. And you will find this on some shelves. In fact, the last time I saw this, it was in a Southern States seed rack. Okay, and Attribute is basically a corn variety that has a BT gene integrated into it. It's resistant to corn earworm. But one of the red flags that this package has on it is that A, it's resistant to corn earworms. B, it's about three times as expensive as the other varieties of corn seed because, again, there is a technology assessment or a patent fee that needs to be paid on that package of seed. But for the most part, our home garden varieties of seeds are easily acquired. And on my website, I'm going to buzz out of this for a minute. I don't have internet access here, but I pulled up a copy of my webpage here. And on my website, this is the homepage of my website, and I can't show it all to you because we've got kind of screwy resolution because of the projectors here. But there are a number of bars across the top here, and if you go to this seeds and supplies bar, I'm sorry, that's the one I'm on. This is the homepage here. If you go to the agriculture page, there's information here about our training programs, about ag biotech information in general. You can sign up for my newsletter here. I've got a couple of blogs where I post information about what's happening at our agriculture center and also issues facing agriculture, the wealth of information here. But if you go to the agriculture page, I've got this seeds and supplies page on here, and I've got a whole list of seed companies that I make use of here. These are the ones that I use. This whole group here where you can buy seed that's free from GMOs and good quality stuff. Now, I suggest that you be wise in your use of seed in your gardens. And one of the ways that we manage our gardens to our best advantage is to provide more than one variety of crop in our gardens. And the reason for that is because every year, weather conditions are a little bit different. Our pest conditions are a little bit different. And the gentleman here likes candy corn, but if the weather is particularly bad for candy corn that year, if he's got two or three other varieties, he's going to have perhaps an abundance in one of the other varieties. So I never put all of my eggs in one basket, so to speak, when it comes to planting anything. When it comes to our lettuce, I plant at least 7 to 10 different varieties of lettuce every year. I plant 4 or 5 different varieties of broccoli, combinations of open pollinated and hybrid varieties. This year we've got 12 different varieties of tomatoes, 5 different varieties of corn, 7 different potato varieties. And there's great advantage to having that kind of diversity in your garden. So I strongly encourage all of you to be attentive to that. And when you make your selections, make it based on something more than just the one that you like the most. Okay? Now, Elizabeth, you had a question? Oh, okay. Speak up, please, so we can hear.
You keep saying things that keep sparking questions. But the first question is, did you say that you got 7 pounds or 11 pounds of cucumbers from that one row?
No, I said 1,100 pounds, 1,100 pounds.
Oh, wow.
1,000.
How long was that row?
50 feet.
Okay, wow.
5 feet by 50 feet, 250 square feet.
Right.
Shorter than the length
now,
of this building.
When you're saying about planting all these varieties of plants, if you're saving seeds, is that still wise to do?
Yes, but in saving seed, I grow crops and dedicate them specifically to that purpose.
So you would have them at a different part of the garden?
I will grow them at a distance from things that might cross-pollinate them, yes. I will try to preserve their integrity, okay, either by time or by distance. There's two ways you can isolate plants. One is time, so that they're flowering at a different time or they're not receptive to pollen at the same time as your other varieties, or distance. But yes, that is an important aspect. Otherwise, you'll end up, you know, crossing pumpkins with your neighbor.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then what about the, with all those pesticides that are being used, when you buy compost or cow manure from the store, is it wise to put it in your organic garden?
I'm going to be discussing soil nutrition issues tomorrow, okay, and I will cover that thoroughly, so please don't miss tomorrow. Okay? Any other? Yes, ma'am.
How far apart are they supposed to be?
What's supposed to be?
Like if you have two types of corn or...
There's not a simple answer to that question. The federal government says that if your biotech crop is 300 feet from an organic crop, that's sufficient. But with an F5 tornado coming through your neighborhood, that's not going to work. It depends a little bit on your topography. There's not a simple answer to that question. I have a number of different fields, and my seed crops, I oftentimes will actually produce inside one of my greenhouses. So that I have a barrier as well. And you know, don't get discouraged when I say greenhouse, because on Friday I'm going to tell you how valuable it is to have a greenhouse and how cheap they are. You can pay for a greenhouse with the very first crop you grow in it. And if that crop happens to be lettuce, you can build that greenhouse and have it paid for in 50 days. Everything after that is free. So there are some methods and techniques that are important in that isolation, but there's not a simple answer to that question. Yes, sir.
Okay, when you buy like seed from one of these companies right here,
yes,
how long are them seeds good for? If you don't plant them this year, can you use the same seeds for the next following year?
Seeds with proper storage can last for periods of years. I actually have some lettuce growing right now in my garden from seeds that are 9 years old. But what I do is I keep all of my seeds in a freezer. I have a little chest-type freezer that I have specifically dedicated to keeping my seed in. And it's not that important that your seed is frozen. What's important is that you have a very consistent temperature and very consistent humidity. Now, the Bible parable tells us that seed is dead. That's not entirely accurate. Seed is not dead. And there are enzyme activities that take place in seed all the time until it sprouts again. And the less enzyme activity you have, the longer that seed will last. And by keeping the seed at a constant temperature and a constant humidity, it will last, in many cases, for years. Now, the exception to that are beans. Beans usually start to lose their viability fairly quickly, within 3 or 4 years. But many of our vegetable seeds will last for many, many years. Now, that being said, I don't want all of you rushing out and buying a package of end-time seed, throwing it in your refrigerator, and turning your back on it. because the best way to provide a good quality seed is to grow it every year. Now, in my case, I grow a lot of open pollinated varieties, and usually I will not keep my seed for more than 3 years at a time before I grow it out again and produce a new supply. But that's ideally what we should do, okay? Any of you end time people that buy seed and throw it in your freezer and then decide that you're going to wait till the time of trouble before you plant it are making a big mistake.
How about if you have the seed in a vacuum container?
You know, that has some advantages if you're in a really humid climate and you can't control the temperature, but there are some disadvantages to it too, because the seed actually needs oxygen. And when you seal it up in a vacuum seal or in a tight jar, you're depriving it of oxygen, and it actually will be deleterious in the long term. I store mine in Ziploc bags in the freezer. I think that's the simplest and easiest way for me to accommodate it. If you have a root cellar, that's also a good place to store seed, but you don't necessarily want to vacuum pack it. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. What I use Ziploc freezer bags, and I double bag my seed to control the humidity. If you keep it in a root cellar where the temperature is fairly constant, it'll last for a good long while. No, you have air in that bag. You're not going to get all the air out. He was talking about using a vacuum seal, which pulls all of the air out of the bag. It doesn't need much oxygen. It just needs oxygen.
Okay, I understand that now.
I just wanted to ask you, I know you said the seed packets would say F1. If it's the seventh generation, will it say F7?
No, it'll say open pollinated or heirloom. Open pollinated is the term that describes a seed that will reproduce true to type. Typically on our seed packages, if you're ordering from a catalog, you'll only see F1. Occasionally, you'll see an F2 variety. They're usually quite expensive because it takes two growing seasons to produce an F2 seed, and they're not very common. But you won't see 3, 4, 5, 6, no. Mm-mm. One more back here, yes.
Is there a special way to clean the seeds before you store them?
Seed should be, well cleaned before you store it, and also it needs to be very dry. You need to have less than 12% moisture in your seed in order to store it for any period of time. Typically, with things like squash and cucumbers and tomatoes, I wash the seed in a screen, I clean it as best I can, then I set it on a paper towel and let it dry thoroughly before I bag it and store it. For things like lettuce and kale and those kinds of things, I'll break the seeds out of their pods. I use a small fan to blow the chaff out of them. But again, you want to make sure that the seed is very, very dry when you store it. Do not put it in the oven to try to dry. Very good point. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Gallimore. You don't want to overheat your seed. You know, I had a friend that tried to use a microwave to dry a seed out too. Not a smart thing to do. So, and even, you know, folks have said, well, what about a food dehydrator? I would discourage that just because of the potential of getting the temperature too high and damaging the seed. All right, I have one more question here in the back.
I love these multicolored peppers.
Yes.
And I have saved my seed for years. And so I decided to buy these really nice big multicolored peppers in the store. And I saved the seed and I planted them. Now,
yeah.
The first year, I had beautiful crop of orange, yellow, red peppers.
Okay.
So I saved the same from that crop. I saved seeds from that.
You were at F2.
And I planted those, and all I got was pepper plants.
Okay.
I didn't get any peppers.
That's the risk you take. You know, most all the produce that we buy in the supermarket is a hybrid. So what you experienced was just what I was describing earlier, is that sterility gene can pop up anywhere in that chain of generations. And in your particular case, it popped up at the F3. But that's what you're describing, yes. So you had a healthy F2 generation, but a non-existent F3. Okay. All right, I have one question up here in the front. Just a moment for the microphone, if you would.
Okay. I've never actually harvested the seeds yet. So if you have lettuce, what do you have to let it go to seed first? Is it like something like, because the lettuce itself doesn't have a seed, so it goes to seed?
Yes, lettuce does have a seed.
Where?
We harvest lettuce before it's ripe. We harvest lettuce before it produces its seed. But lettuce, when it's fully grown, will be about this tall. And from the center of the lettuce plant will come a large flower spike. And you will get many different yellow, typically yellow flowers on lettuce. And those will produce a very small seed. It takes a much, much longer period of time. Typically, when we're harvesting greens, we're harvesting them long before they're in that reproductive phase.
Okay, so you have to let them grow out.
You have to let them grow out completely.
The seed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
This time of year, if you go home and you plant lettuce right now, you'll have a chance to see this, because it will, in hot weather, the term for it going to seed is bolting. It will bolt very quickly in this kind of weather, probably before you want it to. It'll start to...
Well, I planted it before we came here. It was only about this tall.
Oh, you're going to have a chance to see it then. Just don't harvest one of them and let it go, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Okay? All right, we're almost out of time. Is there another question? Okay. All right. Now, I know there are many, you know, I can't make... Yeah. Okay, one more. Oh, one more, and then I'll conclude here.
There was a neighbor that gave me these bean seeds, and he has stored it in his root cellar for a long time. He said he put a cloth in it and mothballs.
And what? Mothballs?
And mothballs. Have you ever heard about that?
Mothballs would simply be there to discourage any insect damage. I would not recommend that. That's naphtha.
That's what I was gonna
yes.
Ask. Yeah. It's yeah. Not safe.
I wouldn't recommend that, no.
Is it safe for me to plant those seeds?
Probably.
Okay.
Yes.
You'll turn into a moth.
Okay. All right, folks. We're about out of time, and I want to give Dr. Kelly time to, or Dr. Clark time to get himself set up here. So. Let me just conclude by saying a couple of things here, and that is that, you know, in the short time that we have this week, I'm probably going to leave you with more questions than I answer. And if that is the case, and you decide that you need more education, this is why we have a training center. So if you've got an interest in learning more about how to be self-sufficient, how to be self-reliant when it comes to producing your food, please see me sometime this week. And we can talk about what the program is all about and what some of the options might be that could work for you. You know, we can't overcome a century of careless ignorance with a couple of sessions on an afternoon. And everybody in today's world is so accustomed to just firing a question at Mr. Google and immediately getting an array of answers that sometimes I'm overwhelmed by the simplistic nature of how we view something as complex as agriculture. It's a very dynamic environment. We're dealing with life here. In many ways, we're dealing with processes that we have very little understanding of. And for someone to come to me and say, for example, you know, Bob, I planted tomatoes last week and the lower leaves are turning yellow, what's wrong? I haven't got a clue, because I don't have any way of diagnosing what's wrong. There could be a whole vast array of different answers that I could give. I really need to observe it and see it. Now, I'm good at diagnosing those problems if I can see them. Why? Because I have experimental knowledge. I've seen all the things that can go wrong. All right? But for those of us that don't have that experimental knowledge, we've got some remedial work to do, folks. We're not going to be able to be perfect the first time. But I don't want you to get discouraged either. You know, we've been so saturated with the images on the cover of Sunset Magazine about what our tomato plants are supposed to look like and how productive things are going to be. And we picked up Organic Gardening Magazine and we see these beautiful crops growing without a weed in place and, you know, massive tomatoes. And we think that if we don't achieve that same thing, we failed. And that's really wrong. That's wrong thinking, folks. Because I'm going to tell you that whenever you plant a seed, this is without exception, whenever you plant a seed, something is going to grow. Sometimes it's going to be the crop, and if it's not the crop, it's going to be you, because you're going to gain experience in why that crop didn't grow, but something always grows. And ideally, what the Lord wants is that they both grow. That each time we have success in the garden, we build on that success too, and we continue to grow. And that's an extremely important aspect of how we need to approach our gardens. Secondly, we want to approach our gardens as a reverent activity. We want to approach it with respect. This is the source of our life, our food. It's the Lord through the garden that provides for us. Folks come to me sometimes and they say, Bob, how do you grow that beautiful broccoli? And I have to tell them, I don't know how to grow broccoli. And honestly, I don't. There's things going on at that plant that I just can't comprehend at all. The Lord grows the broccoli. He's given me experience and opportunity to develop skills to care for it and nurture it, but I don't grow it. And we have to recognize that power in the garden too, so approach it reverently as well. All right, I want to close so that we can give Dr. Clark his sufficient amount of time, but I want to thank you for coming today. Tomorrow we're going to be discussing soil, so bring your notebooks again and we'll get into that. Let's have a quick word of prayer, shall we? Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the freedom and the opportunity to assemble here and to discuss these issues. And my prayer this day, Father, is that everyone here has been encouraged and realizes greater the desire that you have for us to assume this aspect of responsibility in our lives and to be more thoughtful about the choices that we make when it comes to how we feed our bodies and the activities that we participate in. May you enable everyone here, Father, to have success this year in their desires to fulfill their gardening desires and bring them a special blessing, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.